published on World Geostrategic Insights on April 30, 2025. Trump's Foreign Policy Issues in the Light of the Geostrategic Sea Land Model. By George McMillan III. 1. The Need for a Baseline Sea Power versus Land Power Geostrategic Model. Unlike functionalist theories, theories of rational behavior have a natural tendency to take a hypothetical-deductive form and explain a wide variety of empirical facts in terms of a small number of theoretical assumptions, such as assumptions about the actual objectives of people's behavior, about the resources and the information available to them, etc. Again, unlike functionalist theories, rational behavior theories can account for social stability and for social change with equal facility, and, by drawing the resource of modern game theory, they can readily analyze both social conflict and social cooperation, and even those uneasy mixtures of the two that characterize most empirical social situation. Baseline understanding of sea power versus land power strategies. The competition among theoreticians is to present theories of human behavior in terms of two-force physics-style models to explain a very wide range of human behavior from just two opposing forces or two competing motivational assumptions. John von Neumann provides the classic example of two-force physics models in aeronautics. Aeronautical models are based on developing functional aircraft that operate in an environment determined by the relationship between the two primary forces of gravity and atmospheric density and the four primary variables of lift, thrust, weight, and drag. His objective in Theory of Games and Economic Behavior, 1944, was to create the methodologies to represent the entire range of the philosophical and social sciences into a two-force physics-style model. Due to his work and many other theoreticians in the major fields of the philosophical and social sciences that is easy to do since December of 2019, the integrated methodological frameworks from that project will be applied to this essay. The model being developed in this research is based on the sea power versus land power dichotomy. Analysts working in the area of geoeconomics and geopolitics could benefit from a coordinated sea power encirclement versus land power overland logistical supply route dichotomy of the global grand strategies. This will make it easier for analysts working on one area to recognize the various global and regional strategies and counter-strategies in other areas and gain a wider perspective on global trends. Analysts from disparate areas of expertise realize that the world is transitioning from a unipolar world to some sort of multipolar world. This paper takes into account the elements of energy, minerals, and agricultural raw materials in the formation of economic trading blocs and military alliances that determine the presence of a hierarchical system of superpower major power vassal states or two. The theoretical game is to describe the present unipolar world in terms of Kennan's original five industrial power center framework, which defined the competing superpower major power vassal state system of the Cold War, which is now being redefined by the present Atlanticist versus Eurasianist conflict by researchers in that topical area. The game among theoreticians is to better predict sea power and land power moves and counter moves by better understanding their strategies. Rational actor belief preference constraint models. The Western financial and permanent state elite employ a sea power strategy to encircle and economically strangle Russia. The open-source versions of the strategies are defined in the series of books written by former U.S. National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski after the Carter administration. Brzezinski's book, parallel with Paul Wolfowitz's strategy presented in the fiscal year 1993-4, is a planning guide that his staff prepared and released in 1992 while he was Deputy Undersecretary for Defense Planning. The gist was that since the Soviet Union collapsed, the U.S. should extend its hegemony over the world and promote democracy and human rights. His biography on Wikipedia is listed below. Paul Dunda Wolfowitz, born December 22, 1943, is an American political scientist and diplomat who served as the 10th president of the World Bank, U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense, U.S. Ambassador to Indonesia, and Dean of Paul H. Nitzer School of Advanced International Studies, SAIS, at Johns Hopkins University. He is currently a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. The third key source for this rational actor model is the two RAND articles published in April 2019. The short 12-page brief was titled Overextending and Unbalancing Russia, and the 354-page version was titled Extending Russia, Competing from Advantageous Ground. These writings are examples of rational actor belief preference constraint, RABPC, models. The pertinence of the RAND 2019 articles is that they were developed during the first Trump administration and published just before the controversial 2020 election cycle in the United States. The RAND articles updated the Brzezinski and Wolfowitz doctrines to provide guidance for the Biden administration. Trump may have won the 2024 election, but the Brzezinski, Wolfowitz, and RAND 2019 strategic planning guidelines still form the strategic plans of the Western financial and permanent state grand strategic level elites who are entrenched in the nine major unrestricted warfare institutions and direct the regional strategic, operational, and tactical levels of warfare. This overarching perspective will allow analysts to readily recognize how a strategic action response in one area of the world by one actor may be countered by a symmetric or asymmetric response in that area, or be countered by a symmetrical or asymmetrical response in a completely different region of the world. The Trump administration lacks a systematic perspective of what the structure is and how it functions to effectively troubleshoot the system. This type of analysis will be provided in this essay. The four levels of warfare and nine fundamental unrestricted warfare domains. In this context, there are four levels of warfare. 1. The global grand strategic level is operated by the Western financiers and permanent state elite who direct the three institutional levels consisting of 2. The regional strategic theater strategic, 3. The operational level, and 4. The tactical level. The four-level warfare hierarchy exists in all nine fundamental institutional unrestricted warfare domains of 1. Financial capital centers of the global power hierarchy who finance the other domains, 2. The global and domestic business world hierarchy, which 3. fund selected graduate schools in the Western university system to support 4. a hierarchy of global research foundations, think tanks, and non-governmental organizations, which form the narrative to guide 5. a global and domestic mass media and communications hierarchy, which interact with the governmental institutional domains of 6. the intelligence community entities that deal with global geoeconomic and geostrategic issues and continually engage in training, equipping, professionalizing, and interoperating with host nation counterparts. 7. The federal military departments that deal with global geoeconomic and geostrategic issues and continually engage in training, equipping, professionalizing, and interoperating with host nation counterparts. 8. The civilian federal law enforcement agencies that deal primarily with domestic issues but continually engage in training, equipping, professionalizing, and interoperating with host nation counterparts. 9. The civilian federal government bureaucracies that deal with domestic issues primarily but continually engage in training, equipping, professionalizing, and interoperating with host nation counterparts. Other theorists may construct the list differently, but this model is effective in explaining how the hierarchy of the world's one percenters hires a stable of political, economic, and geopolitical analysts that comprise the grand strategic level of warfare. The grand strategic level financiers work in conjunction with the permanent state elites to direct the strategic, operational, and tactical level personnel in all nine of the institutional domains. They use the sea power versus land power grand strategies to direct the Western governments to take courses of action based on the false cover for action narrative so they can socialize the costs and privatize the profits. As many alternative media channels have illustrated, every night local, national, and international cable news outlets report on the same news items using the same framing and phrasing every day and night. Western mass media script writers. Someone is obviously writing the scripts and disseminating them to the local, national, and international news organizations every day. This has been obvious for over a decade now and explains why the cable television generals repeat the same talking points every night without reflection or circumspection. It also explains why Keith Kellogg put forth a plan that Lavrov rejected since the publication of the plan in April 2024. It is this phenomenon that the four levels of warfare and nine domain structural functional analysis are to be performed in a dynamic sea power versus land power model. What needs to be explained is how a tiny fraction of the people on the planet can control the information and activities across so many hierarchical domains in one sense, and explain why they have weaponized all nine domains against Donald Trump and all the populist politicians and their supporters in North America, the United Kingdom, and Europe. While Russia's overland natural gas pipeline network may not be a space-age revolutionary technology, it nevertheless represents a new method of transforming energy production into wealth via international trade at such high volumes that has the potential to drastically shift the global political center of gravity. The Western financier and permanent state elite do not want the global political center of gravity to shift. This is what is behind the forever wars and Putin's reluctance to agree to a ceasefire with the Trump administration. Putin's strategy is against Western financiers and the permanent state, which will stick around even after Donald Trump's demise unless sufficient action is taken to dislodge them. The four levels of warfare and the nine institutional domains expressed in a sea power versus land power dichotomy represent a means of explaining a very wide scope of phenomena from just two competing forces. Two force models are the logical progression of explanatory and predictive models. The model will facilitate the understanding of the forever wars and how to stop them. 2. The railroad and the evolution of sea power versus land power strategies. The sea power encirclement versus land power overland logistical supply route and limited maritime breakout strategies was the essence of Mackinder's The Geographical Pivot of History, published in 1904 at Oxford, which was followed by Democratic Ideals and Reality, The Geographical Pivot of History, 1919. The books highlighted the advantages of overland logistical supply routes to connect energy, mineral, and agricultural resources from the Russian heartland to the German-speaking industrial world and bypass maritime passage via the Baltic Sea. Mackinder emphasized the need to control Poland and Eastern Europe to prevent a Haushofer integration of the German and Russian economies at the turn of the 20th century. Mackinder's analysis spawned Spickman's America's Strategy in World Politics, The United States and the Balance of Power, which was published in 1942 while he was a professor at Yale. Spickman emphasized the importance of the sea power to control all of the coastal rimland seaports in Eurasia to mitigate the ocean access of the Soviet Union across Eurasia as a whole. When one factors in Peter Hopkirk's books on the Great Game, 1990, and Central Asia during the period of the British Raj, then one understands that the Atlanticist versus Eurasianist rivalry has existed for centuries. It has culminated in two world wars, with continuous proxy wars occurring before, during, and after the world wars. There was never a period of peace. The French Indochina and Vietnam wars in Southeast Asia may have been in a different time and place, but the actors are the same and the Rimland encirclement versus heartland breakout strategies are the same. Iran and the Atlanticist sea power versus the Eurasian land power strategies. It is these Atlanticist sea power versus Eurasian land power strategies that are driving the present conflict zones across Eurasia, not just the Russo-Ukrainian war and the anticipated air power battlefield shaping operations in Iran. The Western financial and permanent state elite are trying to induce an Azeri, Kurdish, and Baloch uprising in Iran to enable Turkey to wrest control of the energy, mineral, and agricultural commodities in Central Asia Turkestans while also controlling the terrestrial land bridge logistical supply routes to Europe without American boots on the ground. The potential attack on Iran is mentioned here because it provides an example of the difference between the ostensible reason for a military invasion or a proxy war in contrast to the underlying resource-based motive of the Western financial and permanent state elites. The ostensible reason is the concern over Iranian-backed Shiite militias operating in the region and concern for their nuclear program. But the underlying reason is to initiate another proxy war to extend the Western superpower major power vassal state hierarchy. In the context of geoeconomic and geostrategic modeling, it is useful to know that the basis of the United States and United Kingdom sea power superpower colonial major power vassal state hierarchy strategy. The goal is to add more vassal states to take over as many energy, mineral, and agriculture commodity-rich areas as possible. To exploit the commodities, it is necessary to control as many maritime, riverine, port, and terrestrial land bridge choke points as possible to control as many forms of logistical supply routes as possible. The commodities must be extracted and delivered to as many Western-owned industrial refineries, processing, and manufacturing facilities as possible to direct as much of the profits from the commodities to the Western financial centers as possible. Proxy wars and irregular warfare, exploiting ethnic, religious, and linguistic rivalries. In the process of extending the superpower major power vassal state hierarchy, the divide and conquer strategy of inciting existing ethnic, religious, and linguistic rivalries seems to be the routine method. This method of starting brushfire wars has been the basis of countless irregular warfare, proxy wars, and insurgency manuals used in the various intelligence community and military training manuals. President Kennedy created the Special Operations Forces community in the military to work in conjunction with the Special Activities Division in the Central Intelligence Agency to address limited levels of conflict. In the four major levels of warfare and the nine fundamental domains, there are above-board overt activities with ostensible objectives, i.e. the cover-for-action narrative, and covert activities to obtain the underlying objectives. The underlying objectives are always proprietary in the business world and classified in the government world. A comprehensive method of analysis is useful in discerning the overt ostensible objective from the covert underlying objectives. The above is true for each country of the world, which makes the understanding of the role of trading blocs and military alliances in the formation and maintenance of superpower-major power-vassal state hierarchies that define the rise and fall of empires. Overarching dichotomies and theoretical investigative models. It is out of these four levels of warfare and nine fundamental domains of unrestricted warfare that the grand strategies can be broken down into the sea power encirclement and economic strangulation. Strategies in contradistinction to the land power overland logistical supply route grand strategies. The advantage of this initial dichotomy is that it provides the basis for one to quickly perform a kibono analysis in terms of the fundamental tactical level opportunity, capability, and intent, OIC, analysis in combination with the legal means, motive, and opportunity analysis. In the tactical world, Colonel John Boyd's observe, orient, decide, and act feedback loop, i.e. the OODA loop, is a fundamental cognitive and behavioral framework that is fundamental to most tactical and operational level training curricula. The idea is that the better trained in their domain area, in combination with pre-prepared courses of action, COAs, or emergency response procedures, ERPs, the better they will perform in strategic competition with rivals at any level in all domains. American football coaches study how many run and pass plays an offense typically runs from a certain down and distance situation and player alignment formations. This analysis forms the basis for them to formulate their defensive counter strategies and convey those strategies to the players in game film analysis and on the field training. Pattern recognition frameworks improve anticipation, which improves reaction times. The defensive players are trained to key on how the offensive players in front of them move in the first tenth of a second after the ball is snapped. The way an offensive player initially breaks indicates which play is occurring. The better the defensive players are trained in pattern recognition frameworks, the better their anticipatory predictive powers are, and the faster and more effective their reaction times and teamwork coordination are. In this example, the defense's OODA loop cycles a few times in less than a second, and the better all 11 players on the field are trained, the better each player processes this OODA loop independently and in aggregate. Knowing what plays the team has used from each formation in the past makes it possible for a team to react within a critical time frame in the future. In the case of governments, the better they are prepared at all levels and all domains, the better they can respond to the strategic and tactical level actions of a rival, or be operantly conditioned to react to the false cover for action narrative without realizing the underlying objectives that derive from the second and third order effects of a particular policy action. Integrated causal geoeconomic, geopolitical, and unrestricted warfare models. While economic growth and political development strategies occur over generations, the OODA loop is much slower than professional athletes competing against one another in a game. Therefore, this type of modeling requires its unique predictive analytical methods used in series. In this case, the underlying methodologies appear in my Unified Behavioral Theory of the Philosophical and Social Sciences, which is an integrated causal model, ICM, of evolutionary, psychological, political, economic/demographic frameworks that determine the geopolitical outcome measure of first and second world more developed countries, and third and fourth world less developed countries. It is this series of frameworks that accounts for the integration of geoeconomic, geopolitical, and unrestricted warfare components of this sea power encirclement and strangulation versus land power overland logistical supply route strategies. The Unified Behavioral Theory / Integrated Causal Model of the Philosophical and Social Sciences is explained in several other documents. It will not be discussed here other than to inform the reader that an underlying methodology exists that integrates political, economic/demographic, and geopolitical frameworks. The sea power versus land power grand strategies explained in this series are based on the combination of predictive analytical frameworks used in that endeavor. That endeavor was inspired by extending the rational actor model discussed by John von Neumann and Oscar Morgenstern in The Theory of Games and Economic Behavior, 1944. Which has since been adapted to the military decision-making process, MDMP. With this explained, The point is that one can much more rapidly perform assessments on global events with a baseline understanding of the sea power encirclement and economic strangulation strategies of the West End, contradistinction to the land power overland logistical supply route strategies than without it. Trading blocks and European mercantilism. It should also be understood that the sea power versus land power grand strategies emerged from the colonial sea power mercantile wars during the age of the great explorers and steadily evolved into the modern conception with the advent of the Dutch East India Company that inspired the creation of the British East India Company as a rival. The colonial sea power versus sea power mercantile wars became the impetus of Alfred Thayer Mahan's The Influence of Sea Power upon History 1660-1805, 1890. Halfred Mackinder's Democratic Ideals and Reality, 1919, and Nicholas Spickman's America's Strategy in Work Politics, The United States and the Balance of Power, 1942. The relevance to the Russo-Ukraine War, the urgency of the neoconservatives to attack Iran, and the reluctance of Putin for a ceasefire based on the idea that Putin's war is against the age-old sea power encirclement and encirclement strategies that began long before Trump became a politician and is likely to continue after Trump is gone. The neoconservatives are operantly conditioned to perpetuate the forever wars. They are not trained in the pattern recognition frameworks of competing sea power versus land power strategies, which explains why any time the U.S. military, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the military industrial complex corporations invade a region, big finance, big oil, big mining, big agriculture, big construction, big tech, and big communications all descend on a location as if it was planned years in advance. It is the sequence of these second and third order effects that illuminate the underlying motives distinct from the ostensible cover for action narrative. In this case, the purpose of the RAND 2019 articles titled Overextending and Unbalancing Russia and Extending Russia, Competing from Advantageous Ground, published in April 2019, expressed the strategic guidelines to weaken and disintegrate Russia into numerous separate oblasts. The purpose of this is for the European Union to absorb the energy, mineral, and agriculturally rich areas into the superpower colonial major power vassal state system as vassal states. The EU and NATO trading bloc and military alliance want to absorb vassal states because the commodities are directed to Western-owned industrial processing facilities that direct the profits to the Western colonial capital cities. If the Russian Federation was merged into the EU as a functional whole, then the profits would be directed to Moscow rather than London and Paris. Therefore, the Russian Federation must be encircled, economically strangled, and disintegrated. The sole purpose of moving the EU and NATO eastward was to erect the EU's tariff and non-tariff trade barriers to stop as much Russian trade as possible with Europe. Putin is trying to win the great game against the City of London. The problem for the Western financial and permanent state elite is the Wolfowitz and RAND 2019 strategies have not only failed but backfired tremendously. Putin has a chance to turn the tables and collapse the Western financiers and permanent state actors by collapsing the European economies and disintegrating the European Union and NATO instead. This is now the only way to end this iteration of the forever wars and do so in his favor. The debt-to-GDP ratios of the United States, Canada, the UK, and several European major powers are at catastrophically high levels. The test is to see if they can survive without Russian energy, minerals, and agricultural commodities or collapse, and conversely to see if Russia and China have a viable overland logistical supply route strategy in conjunction with a maritime choke point breakout and mitigation strategy to excel. The very fact that Trump's foreign policy team put forth Kellogg's ceasefire plan and thought that Trump was dealing from a position of strength indicates that his team does not understand how integrated geoeconomic, geopolitical, and unrestricted warfare models work. They could not anticipate the strategic response to an adversary because they did not know that Putin and Xi developed their strategies against the ongoing sea power strategies of the Western financial and permanent state elite. Trump's domestic strategy is based on reducing the twin international trade and annual budget deficits that, if left unabated, will lead to financial insolvency. The reciprocal tariff strategy is both a domestic and foreign policy issue. The more Trump's domestic and foreign policies are coordinated, the better they will work. A comprehensive sea power versus land power model will improve the anticipatory skills of his advisory staff. 4. The first 16 concerns of the Western financiers, the superpower major power vassal state hierarchies, and dime integration. What needs to be stated at the outset is that geoeconomic strategies are based on infrastructural, economic, diplomatic, and military dime integration of trading blocs and military alliances. The goal of geoeconomic strategies is to peacefully trade for energy and mineral agricultural commodities to transform into finished goods that can be delivered and sold to consumers where the profits are split between the corporations and countries involved. Geostrategic plans are based on maritime, riverine, port, and terrestrial land bridge choke point strategies. Geostrategic plans are based on A, extending the superpower major power vassal state hierarchy, B, moving up in a trading bloc and military alliance hierarchy, C, defecting to another hierarchy that offers a better deal, and D, sabotaging the geoeconomic strategy of arrival. The first point is that there are too many aspects of the post-global war on terror, GWOT, Eurasian Rimland Natural Gas Wars to explain in a single paper. Hence, this series continues to present the sea power versus land power struggle in Eurasia in digestible doses. The objective is to provide the reader with an explanatory theory that has predictive power. It will provide the reader with the ability to quickly perform a Kobono analysis and see through false flag events. The sea power encirclement and economic strangulation strategy of Russia's ports at St. Petersburg, Crimea, and Vladivostok has been occurring since the opening of each port. The encirclement of Russia in Central Asia has occurred since the days of the British Raj. Peter Hopkirk has written several books on the topic. Like most books cited in the series, they can be inexpensively purchased at used bookstores, and quite often there are YouTube videos and synopses online. The second point is that the GWOT invasion of the Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia, MEA/NA/CA, and the movement of the EU and NATO eastward was about preventing the Russian Federation from establishing its pipeline network to the coastal Rimland industrial power centers. Since propaganda is based on providing the public with half-truths, providing the reader with additional information and assessment methodologies is essential. Western cable news is nothing but half-truths. As Doge discovered, the US and UK governments spend billions of dollars to censor social media and support thousands of alternative media Operation Mockingbird channels. True independent media does serve the purpose of crowdsourcing the truth, but alternative media only yields fragmented information. Industry journals written by people with STEM degrees tend to be the best sources of information. With this being noted, having integrated geoeconomic and geostrategic models allows one to process the fragmented information into the areas of cooperative geoeconomics development theory and destructive geopolitical sabotage strategies, which entail unrestricted warfare targeting packages. Each one of these three areas occurs in all nine institutional domains at all four levels of warfare. A researcher can process information much faster with this method of modeling than without it. What is essential to know is that Russia has huge oil and natural gas fields from the Caspian Sea area to the entire range of the Arctic Sea, the Far East, and Sakhalin Island. A natural gas pipeline network to all of the coastal Rimland industrial power centers of the German-speaking industrial world, India via the International North-South Trade Corridor, to China, South Korea, and Japan would have infrastructurally, economically, diplomatically, and militarily integrated Russia with all of the major industrial power centers and would have superseded the US and UK's geopolitical alliance network. From this premise, one can see why the US and UK sea powers aggressively moved the EU and NATO eastward and used the EU's tariff and non-trade tariff barriers to thwart Russian trade to Europe, then used the Global War on Terror, GWOT, to move into the Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia, MEA/NA/CA, and used the USAID, NED, and Western financier-backed NGOs to increase political turmoil in Southeast Asia on ethnic, religious, and linguistic lines. The more people understand this pattern of irregular warfare since World War I, the more they will understand the sea power encirclement and strangulation strategy of Eurasia and understand Russia's and China's overland logistical supply route counter-strategy. This makes the anticipation of an actor's response much more likely than without it. Keith Kellogg and the rest of the television generals have no idea how to develop these types of models. They are completely miffed by the response of Putin, Peskov, Lavrov, and Medvedev. In contrast, the author released several videos based on the slogan that all Putin has to do is nothing other than sit back and watch the European economies collapse without Russian and Caspian Sea area energy and minerals. The third point is that Nixon and Kissinger's strategy to economically and diplomatically integrate with China and draw it away from the Soviet Union has backfired severely. The offshoring of manufacturing jobs from the U.S. to China since the 1970s has had disastrous consequences. President Trump, along with many others, has spoken out against this over the decades and is now trying to reverse this process. But since the offshoring of jobs began in the 1970s, one wonders how much can be reversed or mitigated in one single presidential term, if Trump can complete the term. The Western financial and permanent state elite will do everything to stop him. The fourth point is that China's Silk Road Initiative was about building overland logistical supply routes to access the energy, mineral, and agriculturally rich areas of the Caspian Sea and Central Asia areas in the 1900s and 2000s. They have since increased their overland logistical supply routes with Russia, especially in the Far East and Power of Siberia 1, with Power of Siberia 2 in the works. The key aspect in this respect is that most of China's population lives in the East. Russia has several large oil and natural gas fields in the Far East, and the number of oil and gas fields connected to the Power of Siberia 1 has been increasing. Furthermore, since the U.S. halted the Sakhalin to Hokkaido pipeline that linked Russia and Japan under diplomatic pressure and prevented the Vladivostok to Seoul Korean Peninsula pipeline also, those Russian energy fields are now connected to Power of Siberia 1 and sent to China. South Korea and Japan are dependent on energy supplies from thousands of miles away over the ocean instead of nearby pipelines. Their alliance with the U.S. increases their energy costs significantly and places them at higher levels of geo-economic risk due to the geostrategic alliances. China's aggressive building of coal-fired energy plants serves the purpose of having as many sources of domestically produced energy as possible in case they are cut off from Middle East oil supplies in the Strait of Hormuz and the Strait of Malacca. Russia and China have been coordinating their overland logistical supply route strategies more intensely since the Euromaidan coup in Kyiv in 2014. China knows that it has to maintain its overland logistical supply routes to Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Iran in Central Asia, as well as to develop its logistical supply routes in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the ASEAN countries to avoid dependence of the Strait of Hormuz and the Straits of Malacca. Both Russia and China realize that they need to support Iran and North Korea to keep NATO off of their doorsteps, whether they think that these regimes are functional or not. Geoeconomics, geostrategic, and unrestricted warfare strategies are based on exigent realism and not idealism. The fifth point is that the purpose of the Belt and Road Initiative is to extend the highway, railway, and pipeline logistical supply routes of the Silk Road Initiative to the Persian Gulf and Iran, and to the Indian Ocean through Pakistan and Myanmar. The purpose of this is to make it possible for ships to offload oil, natural gas, and cargo at the closest port and avoid the Strait of Hormuz and the Strait of Malacca. Since China imports approximately 40% of its food from over the ocean Anglosphere sources, it has begun extending its logistical supply routes into Southeast Asia. Thailand has a highly developed network of highways that the U.S. built during the 1950s and 1960s to feed its air bases in the region during the French Indochina and Vietnam Wars. Laos and Cambodia are drastically underdeveloped due to their communist governments of the 1970s and 80s. What this means is that China can nearshore all of its agricultural needs by upgrading a few more major roads in Laos and Cambodia. They have increased this effort since Trump's first term in office. To be successful in a trade war with the U.S., they will need to turn Laos and Cambodia into farm country by recruiting, training, equipping, and deploying the farmers with tractors and combines. The sixth point is that the purpose of China's Belt and Road Initiative in the Gulf of Thailand is to make it possible to offload goods in Cambodia and deliver them to Kunming by road if necessary. The massive building of bases in the man-made islands in the South China Sea is to cut off the Philippines, Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan from Middle Eastern oil going through the Strait of Malacca or coming from the Borneo, Malaysia, and Indonesian regions. The purpose of building bases in the Solomon Islands is to force any oil tankers that sail around Australia and New Zealand to have to swing farther to the east if they want to sail to Japan. Everything about China's Silk Road and Belt and Road Initiative serves the geo-economic purpose of infrastructurally, economically, diplomatically, and militarily, dime, integrating with its Eurasian neighbors. This means integrating with the Eurasian Economic Union countries in Central Asia to its north and west, with Pakistan and Myanmar to the west, and the ASEAN countries to its south. The two logistical supply route initiatives serve the geo-economic purpose of acquiring energy, mineral, and agricultural resources from its neighbors through trade, and the geostrategic purpose of avoiding or mitigating the sea power maritime choke point strategies peculiar to each region. The seventh point is that the geo-economic and geostrategic aspects of the Silk Road and Belt and Road initiatives produce an inflection point for the sea power strategies. The more China and Russia develop their overland logistical supply route strategies for dime geo-economic integration and avoid geostrategic choke points with overland logistical supply routes, the more that sea power's maritime choke point strategy is negated. In response, the sea power strategy has been to aggressively extend their maritime choke point strategies and take over riverine, port, and terrestrial land bridge choke points to involve themselves in ever more overt activities in the Eurasian Rimland regions. Where covert activities cannot be done, the sea power strategy has been to revert to covert sabotage activities and blame it on age-old ethnic and tribal rivalries. The vast majority of the people can recognize the tactics, training, and procedures to differentiate covert sabotage operations from domestic crime. Hence, the Rimland of Eurasia is replete with proxy wars and color revolutions as part of the maritime, riverine, port, and terrestrial land bridge choke points. The eighth point is that the Ukraine war has indeed been provoked by the West since the Cold War intentionally, which is why this paper stresses the difference between constructive geo-economic trade and destructive geostrategic plans. Following the sea power versus land power strategies of the Mahan, Mackinder, and Spickman-Thod lineage, the US and the UK financial centers moved the EU and NATO eastward into the Baltics, Poland, Ukraine, and Georgia in the South Caucasus to construct a cordon sanitaire to stop all Russian trade to the West. The ninth point is that the primary purpose of Western trading blocs is to extend a superpower, major power, vassal state hierarchy to take over as many petroleum reserves, mineral deposits, and agricultural commodity regions as possible, then direct the commodities to refineries, mills, industrial processing, and manufacturing facilities owned by the trading bloc hierarchy, which serves the purpose of directing the profits to the major banking centers. This is a key point because the current Atlanticist sea power versus Eurasia land power strategy is the US/UK/5I/EU/NATO alliance that is trying to prevent a Russian and Chinese alliance from becoming a Eurasian Economic Union alliance that is dime integrated with ASEAN. This is the current struggle and the reason that the Western financiers and the permanent state alliance perpetuate the forever wars in the Eurasian heartland regions. Whoever accomplishes the geo-economic dime integration better controls the most commodities and can control the maritime, riverine, port, and terrestrial land bridge logistical supply route choke points, can send the raw material commodities to their industrial centers, and can direct the profits to their financial capital cities and can control the reinvestment monies needed to continually expand and strengthen. This is the rationale behind the Brzezinski, Wolfowitz/Rand 2019 strategic guidelines. The 10th point, the expansion of the EU and NATO eastward was meant to strangle the Russian economy and collapse them economically, with the intent of disintegrating them politically. The disintegration of the Russian Federation into several smaller independent oblasts is so the EU and NATO could add several energy, mineral, and agriculturally rich vassal states. By doing this, the US/UK/5I/EU/NATO alliance system extends the Western superpower major power vassal state hierarchy to absorb the entire Russian Federation as powerless entities and the Central Asian Commonwealth of Independent States into the Western system. The 11th point, the purpose of building integrated geo-economic, geostrategic, and unrestricted warfare hypothetical strategic plans is that it allows one to begin that model from the open-source Brzezinski-Wolfowitz/Rand 2019 strategic guidelines and speculate about the closed-source strategic plans. Once one realizes what the purpose of moving the EU and NATO eastward is about, then one can see what the purpose of GWOT and the aggressive movement into the ME/NA/CA is about, and what the Arab Spring color revolutions were about. The common thread about these operations is that they moved the US, UK, and NATO militaries into North Africa, the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, the Caspian Sea, and Central Asian stands, which are extremely rich in oil, natural gas, minerals, and agricultural commodities, and took control of the maritime, riverine, port, and terrestrial land bridge logistical supply route choke points, which served the purpose of extending the superpower colonial major power vassal state hierarchies that feed the Western financial capital cities with profits. The superpower colonial major power vassal state hierarchy phrasing is used in place of the colonial core and peripheral colony terminology that the dependency and structural schools of economic thought used during the mid-20th century. While conceptually similar, the superpower major power vassal state hierarchy verbiage is much more explanatory in terms of the current sea power versus land power struggle in Eurasia. Each side has all four levels of warfare and the nine domains, which makes the structural functional approach appropriate within a dynamic modeling methodology. The second purpose was to encircle and economically strangle the Russian Federation along with the Commonwealth of Independent States. The purpose of encircling the Russian Federation is to take over the maritime, riverine, port, and terrestrial land bridge logistics supply routes, interfere with Russian commerce, disintegrate the Russian Federation into several small oblasts, and separate Russia and China from access to the commodities-rich Central Asian stands as mentioned in the previous papers as well. The end game was for the US/UK/5I/EU/NATO alliance to absorb a vast number of vassal states from the present Belarus and Russian borders to the Far East and the Kuril Islands. This hope for set of chain reactions would then send all the commodities would be processed through industrial facilities owned by the Western financial centers, whereby the profits would all end up in New York, the City of London, Paris, and Basel. Why is this significant? It prevents the profits from going to the Eurasian financial capitals and would stymie an export-led growth and development strategy from working. The Western financial and permanent state elites do not want the profits to go to Moscow and Beijing. The 12th point revolves around what would the Wolfowitz/Council of Foreign Relations/World Economic Forum Global World Order look like? The answer is that it would be nothing like Kant's Perpetual Peace, 1787, consisting of a world full of democratic republics, organized by international organizations that would promote economic cooperation and peace through economic interdependencies. Kant was trying to figure out a way that the energy of the perpetual ethnic, religious, and linguistic rivalries could be transferred into economic competition instead of war. The reality is that the dependency and structuralist arguments of Priebisch and Singer, advanced by Richard Audi's resource curse theory, 1994, were used as an owner's manual to perfect the superpower major power vassal state hierarchies in three ways. First, to utilize Mahan's method of economic strangulation by naval blockades that prevent a rival from turning their production into wealth through trade and prevent a rival from acquiring a critical strategic supply. Second, use the age-old divide-and-conquer strategy of inciting conflict between ethnic, religious, and linguistic rivals with the goal of economically, financially, politically, and militarily destabilizing a rival. Thirdly, the end goal is to turn the targeted country into a vassal state that feeds the colonial major powers with commodities. The Western financiers have become extremely adept at capturing all commodity-rich areas from the age of the great explorers that spawned the colonial era, when they were originally focused on simple agricultural products such as spices and trading nominal finished goods. However, with the advances in the Industrial Revolution, the industrial refining and manufacturing processes became more multi-phased and complex. This complexity rose directly in proportion to the needs of external and internal combustion engines and the use of electricity for lighting and communications. The metallurgical demands of internal combustion engines and electrical generation facilities drastically increased the complexity of the industrial processes and therefore shifted the purpose of the overseas trade from acquiring agriculturally rich areas to acquiring energy and mineral commodity rich areas instead. The more the Western industrial system relied on internal combustion engines and electrical communications and lighting demands, the more the geoeconomic strategies changed, leading to a change in geostrategic planning as well. It made more geoeconomic sense to move first world manufacturing jobs to the third world colonies for several reasons. First, minerals and fossil fuel energy supplies are too bulky to ship arbitrarily. The process of bringing minerals and energy to make steel and alloys demands greater geographic efficiencies. This meant following the advice of the dependency and structuralist school theorists, moving the value-added factories to the developing world and improving their economic sectoral growth. Secondly, the finished goods can be shipped directly from the developing world, minimizing needless transportation costs to the first world when all of the energy and mineral inputs can be brought together within a given region. Then it makes more sense to extract the raw material inputs and combine them in the processing and manufacturing processes, and then ship the finished products from a central shipping point in the region. Thirdly, the financiers and multinational corporations can take advantage of lower third world wages. Many people would place this reason first, but it is placed third here because that only makes sense for low technology and high labor-intensive jobs such as textiles. The deciding factors in metallurgically intensive areas and petrochemical industries such as rubber and tire manufacturing, the shipping costs of the energy and mineral raw materials is much more of a cost factor. It simply is much cheaper to produce automotive tires in Southeast Asia because the petroleum inputs are nearby and so are the rubber tree plantations. It simply made more geographical sense for the North American and European tire manufacturers to replace their aging factories in the first world with brand new state-of-the-art mega facilities in Southeast Asia. What remained the same was to use the factories as a method to employ the offspring of the local elite families and politicians while still sending the lion's share of the profit to the Western financial capitals. The movement of first-world jobs to third-world countries became more about enhancing a method of elite capture and extending the superpower-major-power-vassal-state hierarchical system than it was about global, economic development theory ideals. The process exemplified by the Dutch East India Company has evolved greatly since the turn of the 17th century but, like everything else, it is better understood in terms of a system of constants and variables. A universal constant of human behavior is the existence of ethnic, religious, and linguistic rivalries. They exist everywhere at all times, especially in Europe. The competing East India companies became adept at exploiting existing rivalries and overt diplomacy with underlying motives that manifest themselves in the covert activities of a state actor, a multinational corporation, or anyone in strategic interaction with a competitor in any activity anywhere in the world. Men and women competing for resources and mates for economic gain and social status are empirical manifestations of the Darwinian process of humans competing for self-survival and the survival of the species. But suffice it to say here that inciting ethnic, religious, and linguistic-based conflict has become perfected in irregular warfare and all unrestricted warfare domain levels and all tactical, operational, regional strategic levels and all 9 institutional domain areas. What has changed is that computers combined with global fiber optic and satellite communications have made the command and control aspects of this process much more coordinated over all 9 domains and all regions of the world in real time. This has placed more wealth and control in the hands of the 1%ers who run the Western financial institutions at the grand strategic level of warfare that direct and reward the permanent state elite when they leave public sector employment. The global grand strategic level of warfare has always existed in the Western financial capitals that form a parallel shadow government. The Western financial sector and its relationship to the 3 governmental institutional levels of warfare, tactical, operational, and regional strategic levels, and geography are the constants that are continually evolving as new technologies arise. The 13th point is that what the global grand strategic level has perfected is the use of mass media communications to mask their underlying motives as they incite irregular warfare to 1. Extend the superpower colonial major power vassal state hierarchies as the means of 2. Taking over energy, mineral, and agricultural commodities, which 3. Necessitates the taking control over maritime, riverine, port, and terrestrial land bridge logistical supply route choke points as the means of 4. Directing the commodities to refining and manufacturing facilities that they own so they can 5. Direct the profits into their banks. The one world government comes down to the breaking apart of the Russian Federation and the Commonwealth of Independent States, the Central Asian stands, and turning them into separate oblasts and republics whereby they can replicate steps 1 to 13 listed above. The sea powers have advanced this method considerably since the Dutch and British East India Companies. Putin, Xi, and especially Modi recognize the patterns and have adopted counter-strategies. The 14th point is that the Western rules-based order is about replicating the points and hope that the leaders elsewhere in the world do not recognize the pattern. Raoul Prebisch and Hans Singer recognized the patterns in the mid-20th century, but their findings were forgotten and need to be reintroduced to the present generation. The processes of the Dutch and British East India Companies advanced over time concomitant with the advances in technology, but the fundamentals are the same. The West may have offshored much of the Western manufacturing facilities to the developing world to be closer to the raw materials, pay lower wages, and ship the finished products from the developing world to the global markets from a more geographically efficient central staging area unique to each economic situation. However, the key aspect is that the manufacturing facilities are still owned by the Western banks and the profits still return to the Western capital cities. They do not want the profits to flow to a Moscow and Beijing Eurasian Economic Union nucleus. That would shift the global political center of gravity eastward. Britain and France want to retain the fantasy of being colonial powers instead of vassal states. The 15th point is related to what Prebisch and Singer argued. Each continent should be organized regionally so the commodity extraction and the manufacturing facilities are funded regionally so the profits stay in the region for reinvestment and more equitable growth in the region. This is a major point extracted from Charles Wilbur and Kenneth Jameson's series of texts titled The Political Economy of Development and Underdevelopment, which appeared in several editions from the late 1970s to the 1990s. While population growth far exceeds economic growth in Latin America, Africa, and Southern Asia, and is the major reason for income inequality between the global South and the global North, the extension of the superpower-major power-vassal-state hierarchy is increasing the effectiveness of host-nation elite capture and could be increasing corruption in the developing world as opposed to decreasing it. One has to wonder if corruption increased or decreased as the EU and NATO moved eastward into Ukraine, or as the US moved into Afghanistan during the global war on terror. The critiques of Prebisch, Singer, and Audie are valid in the Global South because the major financial, energy, mineral, and agricultural commodities companies perfected the art of elite capture ages ago. Once these firms descend on a commodity-rich area, they financially support the local politicians, then hire their family members, create international schools for their offspring, send them to Western universities, and then employ the children of the elites in the multinational corporate ecosystem. This phenomenon is not necessarily bad, and it can be extremely good if equality of opportunity is increased as opposed to being decreased. The 16th point is related to the Gorbachev plan to transform the communist non-market economy back to a market economy because bureaucratic systems are inherently massively corrupt and inefficient. Bureaucracies always make things easier for the people behind the counter instead of in front of the counter, but Vuddy 2002, the power-hungry bureaucrats always spot the up-and-comers and get rid of them. And as production levels decrease instead of increase, the bureaucrats pretend to pay people and people pretend to work as passive aggressiveness becomes the modal character orientation and bureaucratic communist and socialist systems always end up sharing equally in the poverty. During the 1980s, Gorbachev wanted to reform the Soviet system by converting back to a market economy. Gorbachev and his advisors wanted to pursue a model similar to China's growth and development strategy that came about in Nixon and Kissinger's ping-pong diplomacy in the early 1970s. But Gorbachev's reforms ended up leading to the fall of the Soviet Union, and the new Russian Federation did not receive a similar treatment that China received. In fact, it was quite the opposite. Instead of the U.S. offshoring its jobs to the new Russian Federation, it sent its big petroleum and mining companies over to extract their commodities, and in league with Western-oriented Russian oligarchs, they replicated a new variant of elite capture and energy and mineral commodity capture. The best way to modernize and develop their economies was for Russia to use its immense oil, natural gas, mineral, and agricultural commodities to fund an export-led growth model that could fund an import substitution industrialization modernization investment program with the back-end profits. But here is the point of contention with the Western financial and permanent state connections that meet in the various Western think tanks, NGO foundations, and foreign policy institute circles. The more that Russia uses its energy, mineral, and agricultural commodities to fund an export-led growth and development model to support an import substitution and modernization program, the more that the profits flow to the banks in Moscow as opposed to New York, the City of London, Paris, and Basel. The enduring theme of the post-Dutch East India Company Western model is to extend the superpower colonial major power vassal state hierarchy to capture the elites and the commodities to direct toward Western banks, not Eurasian banks. The Western financiers and the permanent state followed the structuralist and dependency school of economic thought resource curse protocol as an owner's manual and backed Eastern European oligarchs who would park their immense profits in the Western banks. In this manner, the joint venture between the Western multinational corporations and the petroleum and mineral extraction enterprises would be directing their share of the profits to Western banks while the elite, captured Russian and Eastern European oligarchs, would park their share of the profits in Western banks also. That way the Western banks get a double share. The more this pattern occurs, the more Russian commodity-driven export-led growth import substitution investment and modernization program is thwarted, and the more the Russian nationalists want to oust Yeltsin and install a leader that would stop this form of double dipping. This point of contention is not obvious to people outside of the industry, and certainly not to Western journalists, news anchors, and television generals who are paid to dutifully read their scripts or face the termination of their contracts. Ping-pong diplomacy versus Russian diplomacy. The Russian nationalist elites wanted a similar deal as China got in the 1970s. They wanted to modernize and westernize and become part of Europe. They wanted Russia to leave atheistic Marxism, return to Christian orthodoxy, and ally with other Christian nations. But as the European Union was moving eastward, why did it stop at Russia's borders? Why is the EU always adding riders in the association agreements that require NATO standard training, equipping, professionalizing, and interoperability riders? Vladimir Putin was put into power by the Russian nationalist elites to put an end to the outflow of capital. Vladimir Putin wrote his graduate thesis on the topic of using energy, mineral, and agricultural commodities to fund an import substitution industrialization and economic modernization program. The more the EU and NATO moved eastward, the more obvious it was that they were extending the superpower colonial major power vassal state hierarchy to take over ever more commodity-rich areas via the ever-evolving elite capture techniques which direct capital back to Western banks. Furthermore, the geo-economic and geostrategic advisors in Russia could not help but notice that the new role of NATO was to provide a cover-for-action narrative to move the United States military to take over the maritime, riverine, port, and terrestrial land bridge logistics supply routes. Operation Sea Breeze began circa 2004 of sailing hundreds of Western naval vessels into the Black Sea to demonstrate that NATO controlled the Bosporus Strait, and the Danube River Valley was a dominant display meant to bring Russia to heel. The more that Putin complained about this at the 2007 NATO summit in Munich and the 2008 NATO summit in Bucharest, the more the Western narrative to dismiss his claims evolved and countered that the EU and NATO needed to be more involved in Eastern Europe rather than less involved. The US then escalated again by training and equipping the Catholic Ukrainian-speaking Stepan Bandera followers in the Galicia region of Ukraine and began deploying them in the Orthodox Russian-speaking areas, in the energy, mineral, and agriculturally rich areas of Ukraine. Then the Western financiers sent ambassadors Jeffrey Pyatt and Victoria Nuland to coordinate the efforts of the Western-financed big tech companies that control the social media link analysis and social engineering platforms, organize the cable news, and coordinate with the Stepan Bandera partisans to be as violent as possible. Professor Ivan Kachanovsky argued on Oliver Stone's Ukraine on Fire Part 2 and elsewhere that it was the right sector partisans who controlled the buildings that the shots were fired from that killed over 100 protesters. The Western media reported that it was Yanukovych's police force that shot the peaceful protesters. It is at this point that Chase Hughes' 20 aspects of a PSYOP come into play. As any false cover-for-action narrative evolves, it invariably goes straight to the bottom of Graham's hierarchy of disagreement and the bottom of Kohlberg's hierarchy of moral development. Graham's hierarchy of disagreement and Kohlberg's level of moral development are useful frameworks to use in conjunction with Chase Hughes' framework. Since they know the color revolution plot in advance, they already have the false cover-for-action narrative and escalation scheme devised in advance. This is not just something that happened in the Euromaidan coup in Kyiv in 2014. It was developed in the Arab Spring a few years prior and used in the U.S. to disrupt the 2020 election cycle with the George Floyd Antifa BLM riots and is currently used across the Danube River Valley countries. The Western financial and permanent state elites try to oust or prevent all populist politicians from gaining power. The reasons why the Western financial and permanent state cabal began to demonize Putin and all populist politicians will be increasingly clear in the Russian natural gas and the 10 fears of the City of London paper in the next article in this series. The purpose of developing rational actor belief preference constraint models is to move the discussion to the top of Graham's and Kohlberg's scale rather than the bottom. The more that this process is explained, the more it becomes easy to understand why Putin has given up on negotiating with Western leaders and why President Trump should try a different approach. 5. The Russian Natural Gas Pipeline Network and Eurasian Dime Integration. The Russian Natural Gas Eurasian Pipeline Network in combination with the joint Russo-Sino-Eurasian Railway Network represents the two overland logistical supply route networks that infrastructurally, economically, diplomatically, and militarily integrate the greater Eurasian landmass following the Dime Measurement Instrument of National Power Model, bypasses the Atlanticist Sea Power Maritime Choke Point Grand Strategy, which moves the most energy, mineral, and agricultural commodities to the most coastal rimland industrial power centers, and directs the profits to Moscow and Beijing instead of New York, London, Brussels, and Paris. The Western financial and permanent state elite extended the Brzezinski, Wolfowitz, and Rand 2019 thought lineage and devised ways to prevent these two overland logistical supply networks from shifting the global center of gravity from New York, London, Brussels, and Paris to Moscow and Beijing. This 17th point has a list of 10 fears that will explain the logical consistency of post-Cold War Western foreign policy and explains why the increase in the color revolutions and proxy wars in Eurasia, to either oust populist political leaders that are in office or lawfare the populist leaders that running for office has radically increased since Trump took office. Russian natural gas via pipeline, growth strategies, and Eurasian integration. Point 17 explains why, out of all the other commodities, Russian natural gas via pipeline represents the biggest threat to the Western superpower colonial major power vassal state hierarchy and therefore Western hegemony. The more the Russian natural gas pipeline network is connected to the coastal rimland industrial power centers, the more Eurasian energy, mineral, and agricultural commodities are directed to Eurasian industrial processing and manufacturing facilities, and the more profits are directed to the Eurasian financial capitals rather than the Western financiers. The 10 fears of the Western financial cabal were explained in more detail in a previous series of articles but are listed here for brevity's sake. The more one understands the 10 fears, the more one will understand why the Western financial and permanent state elite put a full court press and moved the EU and NATO eastward and the US military and all none domains into the MI/NA/CA during GWOT to encircle, economically strangle, and disintegrate the Russian Federation and break into the Central Asian stands to prevent a European Economic Union from forming at all costs. The short answer is that they wanted to make sure that the Eurasian Economic Union did not encompass the entire Eurasian landmass, but like someone with narcissistic personality disorder, they might have created the conditions under which their worst nightmare becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The pursuit of the Wolfowitz doctrine may have produced the double negative of accelerating the strange death of Europe while also accelerating the Eurasian Economic Union, ASEAN, and the Danube River Valley Central European Mega-Eurasian Trading Bloc. The first fear is that Gazprom is a state-owned company and has exclusive rights to selling natural gas. The significance is that all the profits flow into the banks of Moscow and can be used to modernize their economy and recover from Soviet communism. The oil extraction part was mainly joint ventures that directed a significant portion of the profits to Western banks but brought much-needed Western extraction technology and know-how to Russia. The Russian nationalists that put Putin into power didn't mind the trade-off as much as they resented the fact that the Western companies were expropriating the profits in combination with the Western chosen oligarchs who were expropriating their share of the profits and placing it into Western banks. The Russian nationalists were upset that the combination meant that a double share was being expropriated. However, Russia's Gazprom had a monopoly on natural gas sales so that money could be reinvested in Russia to fund their commodities-based export-led growth strategy. The more people understand the 10 fears, the more they will understand the present extinction burst that the city of London, Brussels, and Paris are going through and why they began projecting their character orientations and began demonizing both Putin and Gazprom. The character projection is the basis of the 9 false cover for action narrative talking points. What the Western financial and permanent state elite do not do is provide the public with comparative sea power versus land power models that explain the real plans and intentions of the various actors involved. The second fear of the West is that natural gas via pipeline is the cheapest and cleanest of the fossil fuels. Any country connected to Russian natural gas via pipeline would have lower energy costs, which would lower their manufacturing costs, making their goods more competitive on the global markets than countries without such inexpensive and clean-burning energy supply. This combination of factors lowers living costs and raises the living standards of the people living in the area. The third fear is that the world's commodities would move closer to the manufacturing facilities that are closer to areas supported by Russian natural gas via pipeline or the Caspian Sea region natural gas via pipeline coming from Iran and the Central Asian stands. The coastal rimland industrial power centers that are connected to Russian and Central Asian natural gas pipelines, the more the wealth would flow into Eurasian banks and not Western banks, and the more the global political center of gravity shifts away from London, Brussels, and Paris to Moscow and Beijing. This is perhaps the biggest factor in the Thucydides trap problem discussed by Graham Allison and others over the past several years. The fourth fear is that Russia has oil and natural gas fields along its entire Arctic range and in Western, Central, and Far Eastern Siberia. The significance is that it can not only send cheap Russian natural gas to Europe, but it can supply India, China, South Korea, and Japan all by pipeline. The liquefied natural gas process consisting of the liquefaction, shipping, and regasification stages is far too expensive to be anything other than a sea power coping strategy to supply allies in the short term. This cost factor leads to the building of the pipelines, and infrastructural integration leads to economic integration, which leads to diplomatic and military alliance integration following the dime measurement instruments of national power. The fifth fear is that Moscow and the Central Asian stands would have the cheapest and most plentiful forms of energy, mineral, and agricultural commodities that are linked to China's massive industrial capacity and technical know-how by pipeline, railway, highway, overland logistical supply routes that avoid the sea power maritime choke points. The combination of the Russian Federation, the Central Asian stands linked to the coastal Rimland Industrial Power Center of China, is the nucleus for a viable Eurasian Economic Union to rival the EU and NATO combination. A new superpower major power vassal state hierarchy would form and all of the profits would stay in Eurasia. The sixth fear is that if a viable Eurasian Economic Union came about, it could absorb ASEAN into a larger superpower major power vassal state hierarchy system as mentioned in the previous papers. The Chinese have built a high-speed railway from Kunming to Vientiane to Bangkok and want to extend it to Kuala Lumpur and Singapore. Thailand already has a well-developed highway and railway infrastructure due to the steep investments made by the U.S. in the 1950s to build air bases in Thailand to support the French Indochina and Vietnam wars. However, the highways in Laos and Cambodia need a major upgrade due to the French Indochina and Vietnam wars followed by the dysfunctional communist governments since the 1970s. The easiest way to explain this is that China needs to extend its highway and railway network to Vietnam and Thailand through Laos and Cambodia and access the Gulf of Thailand. The more this occurs, the faster Laos and Cambodia develop and the more China infrastructurally, economically, diplomatically, and militarily integrates with ASEAN. In this rubric, the Chinese are extending their highway and railway network from north to south to gain access to the Gulf of Thailand. To counter this, the Western powers are building west-to-east highways from Myanmar to Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. The Japanese are upgrading Route 9 in Vietnam from Dong Ha to Khe San, Vietnam, to Savannakhet, Laos, and Mukden, Thailand on the Mekong, to Malamine, Myanmar. They want to have an overland logistical supply route in Southeast Asia that goes from the South China Sea to the Indian Ocean and connects to Thailand's Eastern Economic Corridor east of Bangkok. South Korea is piggybacking from these infrastructural expansion routes because Samsung Electronics and LG Appliances are well represented in all of the ASEAN countries. The ASEAN countries are becoming more economically important and the major industrial powers in the region want to develop and control the major logistical supply routes. The seventh fear is that if a Eurasian Economic Union and ASEAN merger occurred, it could conceivably create the conditions under which the Eurasian Economic Union would rival the US, UK, Five Eyes, EU, NATO, and Pacific Rim First Island Chain Alliance of the Philippines, Taiwan, South Korea, and Japanese Alliance. This alliance comes under threat if South Korea and Japan choose to complete the natural gas pipelines from Russian petroleum fields to their respective countries to remain globally competitive with China and compete for access in ASEAN and the Indian subcontinent countries as well. The eighth fear is in Eastern Europe and explains why the Western financial and permanent state elites moved the EU and NATO eastward and followed the Brzezinski, Wolfowitz, and Rand 2019 thought lineage. Had the US not heavily influenced the elections in Bulgaria and Romania over the past two decades, then the South Stream pipeline under the Black Sea from Novorossiysk to either Romania or Bulgaria would have been completed. The US and the UK heavily influenced the elections in Bulgaria and Romania to prevent this in 2011-4. The Nord Stream pipelines were heavily protested by the Western financial and permanent state cabal but were completed by Gerhard Schroeder. They were eventually sabotaged. However, the reason that both the South Stream and Nord Stream projects were thwarted is clear in the dime integration reality. The more two countries are infrastructurally integrated, the more they become economically, diplomatically, and militarily aligned also. The fear is that the more Russia and Germany infrastructurally integrate as part of their Ostpolitik, it would not be just Germany that would be dime integrated with Russia. It would be the entire German-speaking industrial world, Germany, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, and Austria, also. Compounding the problem is that the Slavic-speaking Danube River Valley world would be connected to cheap Russian natural gas via pipeline also. The significance of this is that if a Eurasian Economic Union were to be fully realized, then it could absorb much of Central, Southern, and Eastern Europe to the west, merge with India via the International North-South Trade Corridor via Bandar Abbas and Chabahar ports while absorbing the ASEAN to the southeast. Ninth fear, if 1-8 were to occur, then how could Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan stay competitive with expensive liquefied natural gas shipped from faraway locations instead of just completing the 40 miles of undersea pipeline to complete the Sakhalin to Hokkaido connection and receive their oil shipments from across the bay as well? From a geo-economic efficiency perspective, Japan buying much more expensive LNG and oil shipments from the Middle East is ridiculous. From a geo-economic geographical efficiency perspective, Japan and South Korea's energy supply logistics are absurd. The liquefaction, shipping, and regasification processes are way too expensive to be economically viable to support an industrial economy. South Korea and Japan can easily complete pipelines to cheap Russian gas. As mentioned above, the Sakhalin to Hokkaido pipeline only needs a 40-mile undersea section to be completed. A pipeline from Vladivostok to Seoul would have to go through North Korea and would take several years, and the plans were presented in 2104. Like all the other pipeline projects, it was stopped under heavy diplomatic pressure from the United States while Nord Stream was directly sabotaged, as are the Chinese pipelines in Myanmar. The tenth fear is the Eurasian Economic Union snowball theory, which surpasses the domino theory of communism by far. Now imagine if the Eurasian Economic Union snowballed into a Eurasian-wide mega-superpower major-power vassal state system, and all of these countries exited the U.S. petrodollar and ceased using the USD as the world's reserve currency. The global demand for the dollar would drop, while the profits from the Eurasian commodities would go through Eurasian refineries, industrial processing, and manufacturing facilities, and the profits would stay in Eurasia. This would be a Mackinder nightmare for London's International Institute for Strategic Studies and the New York and D.C. research foundations, think tanks, and NGOs as well. But the Western financial and permanent state elite, like any other international actor, is not going to convey its actual strategic plans for operational security reasons. Instead, they convey a list of false cover-for-action narratives to conceal their underlying motives through the newsprint, online, cable television, and social media platforms that they control. The point is to censor, drown out, and fragment as many alternative media sources as possible. If the Western financial and permanent state elite is trying to fragment the information flowing from the alternative media reporters, the purpose of a geo-economic, geopolitical, and unrestricted warfare domain model is to integrate the fragmented information by creating comprehensive interdisciplinary models. Mackinder's and the Institute for International and Strategic Studies' worst nightmare. The sources used in this series, and all of my other series of papers and slide sets, are based on texts and documents from the Western military academies, war colleges, and major universities. This is where I extract the beliefs, preferences, and constraints required to build rational actor belief, preference, and constraint, RABPC, geo-economic, geostrategic, and unrestricted warfare integrated causal models. The City of London's real fear is expressed in the 16 points explained in the previous paper. The more one understands the 16 points, the more the past 3 decades of Western foreign policy makes sense, and the more one will realize that Putin and Xi have formulated their overland logistical supply route, strategy, and strategic interaction with the Western financial and permanent state cabal that controls all 4 levels of warfare and all 9 institutional domains. Putin's strategy is aimed at fighting the Western cabal, not Donald Trump. The entire movement of the EU and NATO eastward, and the movement of the U.S. military into the Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia, MEA/NA/CA, was to A. move into the energy, mineral, and agriculturally rich areas, B. take over the maritime, riverine, and terrestrial land bridge choke points to control all logistical supply routes, C. exploit all ethnic, religious, and linguistic rivalries in each region to engage in proxy wars against Russia in an extension of the Great Game. Hopkirk 1990, or The Strategies of Containment, Gaddis 1982, 2005, 2011, to extend the US/UK/5I/EU/NATO alliance, D. hopefully separate Russia and the Central Asian stands into separate and uncoordinated oblasts, E. expand the City of London-based Western superpower major power vassal state hierarchy throughout Eurasia, F. send all the commodity profits to the Western banking system, and G. achieve the one world government in Eurasia. Making Sense of the GWOT Era. The 18th point is that the more one understands the first 17th points, the more everything that happened over the past three decades makes sense. The West moved the EU and NATO eastward and cut off all trade with Russia while screaming the cover for action narrative that it was Russia that was going to invade Berlin and Paris any moment. The city of London was not at all worried about Russian military expansion, otherwise they would have increased their defense spending and urged everyone in Europe to do the same. Instead, they scoffed at Trump for insisting that European countries contribute more to NATO when he came to office in 2017. The Western financial and permanent state elites went to extreme measures to cultivate the Steele dossier between London and Washington and entrap George Papadopoulos, Carter Page, Paul Manafort, and Michael Flynn to torpedo the Trump presidency. The city of London declared war on Donald Trump and all of his supporters by taking that course of action. They have only accelerated this course of action. They have not stopped, nor do they plan to until Donald Trump is eliminated. This is common knowledge. Dan Bongino wrote Spygate, The Attempted Sabotage of Donald J. Trump in 2018, Exonerated, The Failed Takedown of President Donald Trump by the Swamp in 2019, Follow the Money, The Shocking Deep State Connections of the Anti-Trump Cabal in 2020, and specifically names the actual people, research foundations, think tanks, NGOs, and law firms and other associations that did everything they could to eliminate Donald Trump and his supporters. Likewise with Mark Levin of Fox News. Yet they support the same people who engineered the war in Ukraine. These are just two examples of Fox News people who know the Western financial and permanent state elites are out to get Trump and his supporters in North America, but believe everything that the Western financial and permanent state elite says about Ukraine. The more one understands the sea power versus land power grand strategies, the more mind-boggling this becomes. Market expansion and logistical supply route area access area denial, A2AD. What the city of London is afraid of has been Russian energy market expansion and economic development, not territorial expansion. They do not need more territory. They need access through the maritime, riverine, port, and terrestrial land bridge logistical supply route choke points just like everyone else. This becomes increasingly clear when one considers the options not taken. The West torpedoed the Intermarium/3C initiative to have a free trade zone and military neutral zone in the former Warsaw Pact countries, and possibly the former Yugoslavian countries, and chose to move the EU and NATO eastward instead for the reasons already explained. As Professor Stephen Cohen, John Mearsheimer, Jeffrey Sachs, Ivan Kachanovsky, Benjamin Abelow, plus lawyer Mike Benz, and movie producer Oliver Stone have been arguing about the U.S. provoking the war in Ukraine is true. The Western hierarchy of dupes. But how does the Western financial and permanent state elite react? Since they control all four institutional levels and all nine institutional domains, and use their various research foundations, think tanks, and NGOs to write the scripts for the television generals, news anchors, and stenographer journalists, and spending billions of dollars to support Operation Mockingbird alternative media influencers to echo the narrative around the world on all social media platforms, the so-called experts can't even differentiate between the false cover for action narrative and the actual sea power versus land power grand strategies because they don't know anything about the competing Atlanticist versus Eurasianist strategies. If one knows the strategies, then the false cover for action talking points become laughable. But if one doesn't know the grand strategies, then the cover for action talking points become believable. Bongino has said routinely, propaganda is not just about telling a false narrative, it is about hiding the information that would lead to the truth from you. The Western financial and permanent state elite have fusion cells to build comprehensive geoeconomic models and strategic plans, whereby they can develop comprehensive geostrategic plans. Since they finance all four institutional levels and all nine domains, they get their research institutions, foundations, think tanks, and NGOs to dutifully espouse a series of half-truths throughout all levels of media and mass communications. They have done this to such a degree that the television generals across the liberal and conservative media spectrum might differ on domestic issues, but agree that Ukraine needs another $100 billion in support and the U.S. must launch a never-ending aerial bombardment of Iran. And they can't figure out the degree that the proxy war is planned years in advance, and dozens of big finance, big oil, big mining, big construction, and big tech firms just happen to descend on the region, as if it was all planned. The Western financial and permanent state elite have perfected the method of socializing the costs of military invasions to the American taxpayer and privatizing the profits. The Western financial and permanent state elite have created such a hierarchy of dupes that it is a source of amusement. The value of this list of points is to operationalize their concepts into a sea power versus land power strategic plans dichotomy to enhance people's ability to quickly interpret events. The United States, Anglosphere Five Eyes, European Union, and NATO trading blocs have been doing everything they can do to prevent a Russian Federation and Chinese overland logistical supply line trading bloc that could turn into a viable Eurasian economic trading bloc, which could then merge with ASEAN to the south and rival the Western alliance system to socialize the losses and privatize the profits. Walking out on a limb and sawing it off. The West has successfully used the EU tariff and non-tariff trade barriers to block all Russian trade with the West. Erecting tariff and non-tariff trade barriers is the mechanism by which the superpower-major power-vassal state hierarchy alliances are formed and maintained. The primary target was to stop all Russian natural gas sales to Europe via its own pipeline system to stop the combined Russo-Sino overland logistical supply route networks. That has been accomplished, and the consequences are that European energy prices have soared because the Greens closed down the Groningen gas field in the Netherlands and shut down the coal-fired and nuclear-powered energy plants in Germany, while the neoconservatives and neoliberals ended all Russian natural gas purchases when the last contract ended on December 31, 2024. The Brzezinski-Wolfowitz/Rand 2019 strategy has backfired because the university system has been producing delusional idealists instead of theoreticians over the past five decades, as explained in the 7P plan of the Left series of papers and the Unified Behavioral Theory/Integrated Causal Models series of PowerPoint slide sets. The Western ruling coalition of neoconservatives, neoliberals, and Green New Deal leftists is accelerating the strange death of the West at a record pace. The German-speaking industrial world is deindustrializing with job losses mounting, the cost of living rising and living standards declining. In contrast, since the sanctions, Western oil companies have been compelled to divest from most Russian oil extraction projects and numerous other joint ventures. Instead of the Russian petroleum industry collapsing, many non-Western firms bought the shares from the departing Western companies and continued petroleum extraction operations as usual. The Russian petroleum industry has not significantly declined. It merely lost direct energy sales to Europe due to sanctions, but they picked up third-party indirect sales. Yes, the Russian companies make less, but the European buyers pay higher middleman prices. The Europeans experience cost-push inflation and become less globally competitive vis-a-vis the companies that buy Russian energy directly, especially natural gas via pipeline. But that doesn't stop the television generals and stenographer journalists from parroting the half-truth that Russia has lost sales with no operational definition. Yes, Russia is experiencing inflation, but that is because the profits from Russian energy commodities are staying in Russia and no longer going to New York, London, and Paris. The Russians have more of a demand-pull inflation because they are scrambling to expand existing businesses and create new ones to fill the gaps of the Western businesses that departed. This is the essence of the import substitution industrialization economic modernization programs described by Singer and Priebisch in the mid-20th century and updated by Salo Swantite models. They are achieving the outcome that they planned for. The Russo-Sino land power alliance with Persian and North Korean perimeter protection. If Russia, China, and Iran didn't realize that the West was vigorously pursuing a Mackinder-Spickman-Rimland encirclement and strangulation strategy against Russia, China, and Iran before the 2014 Euromaidan coup in Kyiv, they certainly did afterward. The Cold War ended in the early 1990s, but the strategy of containment was revamped to stop the Eurasian Economic Union snowball theory. The more that the Western financial and permanent state elite pursued the encirclement, economic strangulation, and disintegration strategy against the Russian Federation and the Eurasian Economic Union, the more Russia, China, and Iran focused on circling the wagons and strengthening their overland logistical supply route strategies. Russia realized that the South Stream, Nord Stream, and Yamal Northern Lights pipeline projects to Europe were a tremendous waste of time and money. Had they devoted those resources to completing the Power of Siberia too, the Eurasian Economic Union project would be much farther along. But now Russia, China, and Iran know that they have to coordinate a defensive perimeter against the Western financial and permanent state elite. The Persians are all too aware of the overthrow of Mohammad Mosaddegh in 1953 and are preparing for a repeat, but Trump's foreign policy advisors seem to be too focused on bombing something to consult with historians and theoreticians. The Wikipedia explanation of the 1953 coup is concise. Mohammad Mosaddegh, A. Persian, IPA, Mohammed, E. Mosaddegh, wink with a frown, B. June 16, 1882 to March 5, 1967, was an Iranian politician, author, and lawyer who served as the 30th Prime Minister of Iran from 1951 to 1953, elected by the 16th Majlis, 4-5. He was a member of the Iranian parliament from 1923 and served through a contentious 1952 election into the 17th Iranian Majlis, 6, until his government was overthrown in a 1953 Iranian coup d'etat aided by the intelligence agencies of the United Kingdom, MI6, and the United States, CIA, led by Kermit Roosevelt Jr., 7-8. His National Front was suppressed from the 1954 election, 9. Before its removal from power, his administration introduced a range of social and political measures such as social security, land reforms, and higher taxes, including the introduction of taxation on the rent of land. His government's most significant policy was the nationalization of the Iranian oil industry, which had been built by the British on Persian land since 1913 through the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, APOC/AIOC, later known as British Petroleum, BP. 10. The City of London wanted the energy reserves in the 1950s, and now that the UK's debt-to-GDP ratio is stratospherically high, they need to collateralize their national debt more than ever. The Wolfowitz/Rand-19 strategies and Western sanctions against Russia have backfired to such an extent that all Putin has to do is nothing but sit back and watch the Western hierarchy of dupes collapse the European economies. The more the European economies collapse, the more the populist parties are gaining power across Europe. If AfD and the FPO gain more power in Germany and Austria, along with Orbán in Hungary, Fico in Slovakia, Vučić in Serbia, and Georgescu in Romania, the entire German-speaking and Danube River Valley-speaking world may become populist, rebuilding Nord Stream, buying Russian natural gas via pipeline to resuscitate their economies, and likely exiting the EU, NATO, and the petrodollar all at the same time. Making matters worse, Maia Sandu, the Harvard-educated and Soros-backed president of Moldova, is not popular and the parliamentary elections are coming this summer. The populist parties are gaining power everywhere along the Danube River Valley. If populists rise to power in the Danube River Valley and Putin moves into Odessa Oblast, then the Russian Federation would be directly connected to the entire German-speaking and Danube River Valley Slavic world by overland logistical supply routes. The United States is desperate to build the mega combined airfield and army base in Mihailovka-Bălnăsăneanu, Constanța, Romania, where it can control the Danube River Valley Delta in the Black Sea. The Russians and Chinese can read maps too. The Wolfowitz/Rand 2019 strategy to prevent the Eurasian Economic Union snowball effect from occurring is making it happen instead. The more one understands how integrated geo-economic and geopolitical models work, the more farcical General Jack Keane sounds as he repeats the Baghdad Bob narrative that Russia invaded Ukraine to restore the Soviet Empire. The Russian invasion of Ukraine is a failure because it is a stalemate, and the Russian economy is collapsing. It appears that Putin has adopted a strategy to not play into the hands of the narrative as much as possible. If Putin advanced quickly in Ukraine, then it would look like his main objective was territorial expansion. Instead, Putin's forces hold a defensive line as the U.S. generals in Wiesbaden send Ukrainian men under Russia's artillery barrages to make it look like Ukraine is winning. In reality, the killed in action and wounded in action, Kia/WIA, ratio more than likely heavily favors the Russian military. As long as this is the case, it is in Putin's best interest to not change his course of action and let the European economies collapse and see if the populist politicians rise to power. The effort of the Western financial and permanent state elite to create a one-world superpower colonial major power vassal state hierarchy might be backfiring and creating the EU/ASEAN/Danube River Valley mega trading bloc instead. The idea that Keith Kellogg and his staff, freshly briefed by the Institute for the Study of War, ISW, and the American Enterprise Institute, AEI, advised the Trump administration to deal with Putin from a position of strength and that Putin would be begging to negotiate a ceasefire makes one wonder why Kellogg and his support staff services are still needed by President Trump. the Brzezinski, Wolfowitz, and RAND 2019 grand failure is likely going to go down as the biggest strategic failure in Western history. The Western financial and permanent state elites have such control over all four institutional levels and all nine domain areas that very few people have any idea that it is the Brzezinski, Wolfowitz, and RAND 2019 strategic plans that are failing. Propaganda and mass censorship work. Knowing how to develop rational actor belief preference and constraint geoeconomic and geostrategic models is the effective antidote. Author, George McMillan III. George has been a private military contractor in Iraq and Afghanistan since early 2010. He has worked as a vehicle explosive detection checkpoint supervisor, future operations planning, atmospheric counterinsurgency intelligence, and an operations security specialist and terrorism threat assessment analyst. Published in World Geostrategic Insights on April 20th, 2025. All rights reserved.